You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It is the Anfield Wrap, and it is the start of a new season. And I know that might seem really, really weird, given that the end of the previous season was indeed arguably Sunday the 11th, at least as far as the men's game is concerned. It has stopped, and now it has started again immediately, because it is Liverpool's first day of pre-season training. The new season starts here. We're going to talk about hopes, expectations, what we think around the younger players. We're going to get into the transfers, but in the context of the homegrown and overseas question. And we will sweep up on the Euros, but that was last season, fucking ages ago. Absolutely ages ago. We're now about this season. And this season is, Dan Morgan, I'll come to you first. The footballers are amassed in Austria in the camp. The first game is in 33 days. Loads of really good players early in the camp. Loads of players who normally aren't the first to the camp. I think this is what's quite interesting, that it is a different crew of ones who are around early. And no one managed to look cooler walking in than Mohamed Salah.
Well, you'd expect no less. I do this. I always have a good look at who looks well rested.
Yeah. He looks fabulously rested.
He looks fabulously rested. Jürgen looks like he's fell asleep on the beach a few too many days. He needs to keep the after sun going, I think, a little bit. A
lot of aloe vera in Jürgen's
Loads
future.
Loads of aloe vera.
Jürgen's done the, like, going away on an all-inclusive for 2 weeks, hasn't he, as his rest?
Yeah.
And then finished it and gone, I need another holiday after that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good point. You think about Sadio Mane's off-season 1920, for example. He comes back and about 2 days later, he's on the bench for the opening game of the season. And he's there now. And
and he's there now, having had a rest.
And I think that's the point, is that it's not just the physical rest. This, everybody needed the mental switch off from last season and what happened, and everybody needed to get away from that life for a certain amount of time, in which, if they did it right, which I'm sure they did, would have felt like, you know, almost an eternal amount of space and time between the sort of freak and anomaly that was sort of 2020, 2021. And I think that is what will play into a huge part of next season when we look at this and we can say, yeah, okay, physically we had players back for the first day of the camp, which we don't usually have, and he was able to work with them from early on and stuff like that. But I think when we're talking about Liverpool's sort of fate come the end of this coming season, I think we will look at it and say, well, how rested were they mentally? How able were they to put aside and just break away from such a tumultuous event, which was last season?
34 footballers, Emma, is a lot of footballers. Everyone looks like they're buzzing, but it is a lot of footballers. What I was interested in was 8 youngsters got an early session last week, which I thought was really interesting. Kometio, Beck, Woodburn, Clarkson, Gordon, Muzlowski, Morton and Elliot, which is interesting. They all got an early session, which suggests to me that Liverpool's pre-season / coaching team expect this to be the real deal early, that they wanted to get a few of those younger lads in, prepped a little bit of head start, because it's going to be intense from minute one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's always good to see the young lads coming into the first team, because I think it provides a bit of competition for, you know, the likes of sort of Salah and Mane and Trent, who are so used to kind of walking into training. And yes, they, you know, they're around elite footballers all the time, but I think it's natural for those to kind of walk into pre-season, maybe think, You know, I can have a little bit of fun for the first week. But by bringing in youngsters who've got absolutely everything to prove, you know, this will be one of the biggest weeks of their lives, you know, to come in and try and impress Jurgen Klopp. There's such a small window for them. So, you know, for them to come in and almost you would expect them to be probably the fittest at that moment. So I think that, you know, that gives everyone else a bit of a kick up the backside.
It feels to me a bit like they come in, they do the session, which will be pretty intense, the younger lads all together last week, get themselves ready. And it's as if there's almost like a list of do's and don'ts from the coaches as well.
Yeah.
Like, this is what you've got to look forward to. This is what you've got to mentally prepare yourself for. This is how it's going to feel. This is the way it is. Let us help you through what this is going to be like from the outset.
Yeah, and it is all about sort of nurturing them and giving them that experience, because you look at squad depth and you look at, you know, the likes of Man City, and yes, they've gone out and spent a lot of money to kind of improve their squad depth, but one of Liverpool's strengths has always been bringing through those young players and providing that competition in training, in pre-season and obviously throughout the season from those young players that are coming through the system. So bedding them in, nurturing them, and yeah, just giving them a real good go.
Interesting stuff on the website. Firstly, I liked Paul, details of Liverpool's warm-up fixtures and subsequent broadcast deals. Details will be confirmed in due course, which is otherwise known as we don't know yet. So, you know, we're doing the best we can. We're playing it by ear as much as everybody else is, number one. The other thing was, Linda's on this, we will use this to go back to basics. When you ask a lot from your players, you have to give a lot as well, and we find all of this in Austria. I quite like the idea that he might have delivered that with a level of threat in his voice, that this is going to be genuine graft, I think, for these footballers. There's a lot within there to be excited about it for them, almost as individuals. I mentioned the younger ones before as well, but there's other footballers, Shimakas as an example, who's back first day, something to prove. You know, you go through the list here, there's a fair few of them where there's a little asterisk next to them with specifically what they've got to prove from day one.
Yeah, there's loads in all of that. I was just thinking, because I've was saying before we started recording, I've unplugged for a couple of weeks, and last time I was talking about footy was probably with you and Dan and Sean on a review a few weeks ago, and we were talking about stuff like this, and one of the things we talked about was where will the camp be, and I reckon there's a massive element in this of there's been like three plans and they've just been waiting to see what's happened, and as soon as it's been you can go to Austria, they've pressed the big red let's go to Austria button. Yeah. And Pep Linders is like, it's great there, you know, and because of this sort of stuff, like, we can do everything. Going back to what I was saying, I think there's a huge element of something we've discussed in the past. I think football fans generally massively underestimate training still and massively underestimate pre-season and what it actually means on the ground to footballers, and how I think we focus so much on the first team players, maybe the first 15, and we forget about all these other lads and how important they are. It was really interesting last week, actually. One of the coaching staff for England mentioned Connor Cody and said he's our player of the tournament. He hasn't had a minute on the pitch, but he is so crucial off the pitch because of everything he's been doing. I saw Keane weeks ago saying, you shouldn't be taking Jordan Henderson because he's not fit enough. And I remember thinking, that shows how little you understand about modern football, or maybe football full stop, which sounds mad considering everything he's achieved in the game. Because even if Jordan Henderson had never played a minute on the pitch, his contribution off it and in training and psychologically and looking after the youngsters would be huge. So there's loads in all of that. We've touched on this in the past as well. The hit this season, hit the ground running idea will be huge, I reckon. And that'll be part of what Linders is saying. We want to hit that first game like that team that everybody else has always gone, we hate playing these lads. Like, we hate them. From the second that whistle goes, I reckon the plan will be every team goes, you don't want to play Liverpool again.
For a minute, well, I agree with you completely. I think in there, there's still more to come. There's still footballers to come back from the Euros and the Copa, Dan. For me, the other interesting thing from last week is the extent to which not just that Harvey Elliott signs a new contract, but he sets his own stall out. Makes it really clear where he sees himself. And he must have been given some significant encouragement in that he wouldn't just go off piste. I would have thought he's very, very clear that he thinks he is going to be getting minutes. He's saying he wants to play for the first team, and then he couches it with he's happy to be in and around the first team. In his own mind, I thought he was about three sentences away from, to be honest, I reckon I should be starting. But that's the attitude that you want from him.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as much as it can be looked at and criticised in some forms, a season in the Championship is no harm at all in that sense. And for any player of a young age, they'll have managed Harvey Elliott from the minute he walked through the door of Liverpool. But from any player of a young age, if you play at a level and then you sort of, in your own mind, it's very easy to believe that you can take your level down a notch. And what I mean by that is if you go to Blackburn, with all due respect, at 17, when you've got all the confidence and charisma in the world, you can walk into Blackburn and go, I'm the best player here. And I think Elliott's been able to do that in the right way. Clearly liked, clearly listens to his coaches, clearly takes on everything he's been told, and clearly has tons and tons of ability. I was certain anyway, not to sort of bang the drum, but you know, I thought he'd be in and around the Liverpool squad next season. And I think when we look at someone like Linders, who is talking about back to basics, which I think is a really fascinating phrase, when we look at this, I think he will need Elliott in and around the training pitch and in and around the environment, because you know, he does the Graham Hunter podcast, doesn't he, Linders, last year, and he says, I miss Harvey. Miss him around the place, I miss him training, because he's a sponge. He just listens to he absorbs everything. And you know, we look at the other younger boys, this type of time in a preparation for any team is crucial, and you've got to have the right people around. Where I think it's doubly important for Liverpool is that I almost think there's a little bit of 2016 in this summer, where I think when Linders talks about back to basics, I think they almost have to go back to Palo Alto and say, well, these are the drills, and you might have done them 1,000 times before, but we had to think on our feet so much last season. We had to sort of adopt and adapt to different things that we have to now reinvest in the fundamentals of what we are and who we are and what we do. And I think to have that around, you need good trainers, you need that balance. And yeah, Elliot's going to be crucial to that.
I think, just come back to you on that, with Elliot, good trainers, but also who you're suddenly training with. When we say before about Sadio, for instance, at the start of the 1920 season, where he's got 2 days and then he's in against Norwich. You've talked in the past where when's Mo arrived, when hasn't he arrived? All of a sudden, if you're Harvey Elliott, you're playing with them properly. You're training with them properly, which you get to do during the week, but it's different. You're going to get to play pre-season games, arguably starting in the front three with the best of the two. And then you can go from there. And I think that's massive, Dan. I think that's going to be massive for Elliott, because one of the things I think he is as a footballer is someone who brings people into the game. And the better the player you can bring into the game is, the better that movement is, the better that touch is, the more you're going to be able to show who you are. I'm expecting big things from Elliott in this little training camp here. I reckon Pep Linders is, I reckon Jurgen Klopp is.
Yeah, and I think that works both ways, though, Neil, as well, in that he knows what happens when he comes up against Derby County's left back.
Yeah.
And that might sound trivial when you're in Liverpool training, but he's just got that little bit more knowledge now. He's got that little bit more of where the next touch takes him. He's got that little bit more of situational awareness that have come from games and come from really high intense games. And we talk about high intense in reference to Liverpool's training all the time. Intensity is the biggest thing, it's the biggest identifier. The Championship is hugely, hugely intense in terms of its pace, in terms of its sort of, yeah, its sort of fire pit, if you like, atmosphere, and that ability to sort of always be on the ball and always needing to be wanting the ball. And so I think that'll work both ways, in that, yeah, Elliott can say, which he has done before, you know, you want to see the bit of Firmino's touch in training. It's incredible. But he also knows now that, you know, when you're coming up against certain opposition, they might show you one way but take it another. And that little bit of coming up against Arlas, I think, is what I'm referring to, that will just give him a little bit more now, where he's not just, you know, rightly so, in many senses, just stood awestruck at international footballers.
What there should also be is fewer players on a recovery curve, Emma. I'm thinking about Oxlade-Chamberlain. Mm. When we talk about who this is a big pre-season for, you know, it's arguably the biggest 4 weeks of Cader Gordon's life. But the flip side is, it could actually quietly be one of the biggest 4 weeks of Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain's, in terms of him feeling as though he can reintegrate himself properly in amongst with the rest of these other lads in a way that says he should be a first-team regular.
Yeah, and I think back to kind of what we were talking about before, where, you know, you look at last season and how stop-start it was. It was so hard to get any rhythm, so hard to get any momentum, and players that were returning from injury, it must have been really difficult to come back into the fold knowing that, you know, basically you weren't going to get any training time. It was play a game, maybe put a bit of ice on, have a bit of recovery, play another game. And it was just that repeat, repeat, repeat all last season. So to actually have a block of time where you can be on the training pitch. Obviously, we've spoken about how important just going back to the basics is and building up those technical skills again. And, you know, it sounds crazy, but for somebody like Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, just to be able to improve on his passing, you know, progressively every day throughout a prolonged period of time, like, probably hasn't had any chance to do that for, you know, for, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years maybe. So,
because he doesn't get the last proper pre-season because he's still coming back from injury. Last summer there isn't a proper pre-season, as we know. This is it.
Exactly. So, it, you know, for somebody of his ilk, that is his time, really, to, you know, to make actual progress on the training ground. That's such a rarity.
On this then, expectations, Emma. I don't want to hear about transfers just yet. We're going to talk about transfers. My point is, from a Liverpool point of view, it is the first day of work and it's the first day of a new journey. A journey that's a continuing one, but a new journey nonetheless. And that's what I think Liverpool's players are all about. It's what Liverpool supporters are about. It's about these journeys through seasons. Liverpool supporters are journey hunters. And as I say, I don't know about transfers just yet. Factor it into your thinking. There's a league to be won. Can Liverpool do it and will they do it?
I think so. I was actually talking about this with one of my friends the other day, and I said, you know, in terms of the level of how much we were above City going into last season, it was massive. So last season for me, you kind of write off, because there was just so many different anomalies, so many things that will just never ever happen again in football. So naturally I looked to that season before, where there was such a massive gap, and I think Liverpool can't have gone from that massive gap to then another extreme where we're so far behind Man City that you're having to chase them up. Surely, if anything, you've kind of met in the middle a little bit. So, of course, Liverpool can challenge for the title. Of course, they can challenge for the Champions League, because at the end of the day, they've still got the same players. They've actually gone out and strengthened, obviously brought in Thiago. Like you say, we don't want to talk about transfers, but who knows, come the end of the summer, what the squads are going to look like. But, you know, when you've got players like Mane and Salah and Thiago and Henderson and Trent Alexander-Arnold, Robertson, yes, there is always a chance to win the Premier League title. Definitely.
On that, Dan, the idea of the one transfer we can mention, because he's in, is Konate, who looks like he's absolutely delighted to be there. And I think that's some other energy that maybe has been a little bit lacking. It became a bit of a slog at times last season, and then they pulled themselves together. But I think the idea of fresh energy, and again, we haven't talked about the players who are recovering from injury as well, their energy, their fact that they'll feel like they didn't actually play last season. Do you think the attitude around that camp from day one will be the job here is to win this league?
Yeah, I think so, because I think, like I said at the top of the show, that there's been enough period of mental rest to make them feel like they can separate what happened before to now. And that's where I think the sort of pressing the reset button comes in. You know, Paul mentioned before, which I thought was a good point about Liverpool starting quick. I think we've got enough of a body of evidence around Liverpool now to say that we can say with a certain degree of certainty that we think and know really, and well, it's mainly hope, but we think and hope that Liverpool can start a season quickly. With a certain degree of confidence that Liverpool can start a season quickly, that they can, you know, be in and around it, that they can qualify from the group stages of the Champions League, although it hasn't always been easy. I think now it's much more nuanced in terms of what we're actually needing to ask is, well, what will Ibrahima Konate's start be like? Because if he starts like a train and he has an incredible opening 3-4 months of the season, then I think Liverpool are really in a position where they can say, okay, we've got things in place here. Other variables, you know, can we get players back who are from long-term injuries? You know, we're talking about that. Can we get enough of a sort of period of rest and recuperation into the players who've gone to the Euros, the Coppers, etc., so on and so forth? So they'll need a degree of luck, of course they will, but we know how meticulous they are in preparation, so I trust them to sort of do what they need to do and yeah, be in and around it for sure.
I think they're going to want to go on both fronts, and I think this is important, Paul. I think they're going to want those players themselves, that there is a number of them who are in the very firmly in the win now bracket. Harvey Elliott's got 16 years of Champions League football to look forward to. Mo Salah's maybe got 4 more, and 2 more playing with these current teammates in the shape that they're currently in. I think they're going to want to run at both, and I think that's almost the key question. Maybe at some point a decision might have to be made between one and the other, but I think he's getting them in shape. It's very 18-19, very 19-20. I think he's going to want them to run at both from minute one, and I think that they'd want nothing less.
I 100% agree. And I think this season, more than any other season, this is going to be a year broken down into chunks. And I would love to see, actually, because we speculated about this a few weeks ago as well, and having seen the list of players we've got reporting on day one, I would love to see our rivals' list of the same day. Because the way the world has sort of moved for us in the past year, we had loads of a shit show last year. But actually, the way things have moved now and the plates have all moved, well, what that's led to is potentially, and this massively depends on fitness of Van Dijk, Matip and Gomez, but let's say even one of them can get a good pre-season so they're fully fit for day one and play with Konate, who's fully fit and can play from day one. We've got an 11 to 13, 14 players for the first game of the season that's had a full pre-season, is fully rested and is superstar level. And I'm not sure how many of our rivals can say that. And it's because of a weird combination of things. So two or three of our huge centre-backs were injured last year and they didn't go to the Euros. And if they hadn't have been injured, they would be at the Euros and they wouldn't have reported on day one, like Man City centre-backs will be doing. We've also got star players who are African who haven't played in the Euros and haven't played in the Copa America. So they're all there on day one. And then the next group in this pack you mentioned earlier, who I'm intrigued by, are the Oxlade-Chamberlains, Naby Keitas, Tsimikas even, who, if I'm them, or if I'm their individual coaches or psychologists or anything, I'm sitting down and saying, lads, what we need from you is the first 8 games. And I think even in the WhatsApp group messages, there's almost like a relay race going on here in our squad. Jordan Henderson's messaging Mo Salah and saying, Mo, what I need you to do, lad, is win the first 8 games for us. So I can still have a break. Robbo can have a break. All the lads who are here can have a break. And then when we come back and we're fully firing, we'll take the baton off you for a few games and you can have a bit of a breather. And then we've got other things that'll disrupt the season, but we can do it in chunks. And if we can do it like that, and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, Naby Keita, if you can come in flying and get us a cup, you know, if you say to Oxlade-Chamberlain, look, mate, all we need you to do is a man of the match performance and 2 goals in the first 8 games. From midfield, sort that out for us, get your season going, get back to feeling the way you used to feel. Well, you start the season on fire then, and it goes back to what we were saying before, your rivals looking at it going straight away into the excuses. We didn't get the full pre-season. That's not fair. And as soon as you can get into that, then we're back to 2 seasons ago.
Yeah.
Where you get your nose's head and we're the ones where everyone's looking at us going, it's not worth it, just leave them.
I think a player that we've not mentioned as well is Curtis Jones, who for me had a breakthrough season last season,
absolutely.
You know, among kind of all of the carnage, I guess. And, you know, the fact that Jordan Henderson is obviously going to be coming back off a busy season. The fact that Oxlade-Chamberlain is coming back off injury, Naby Keita is coming back off injury, Thiago hasn't quite embedded yet. It could be a good, big first few weeks for Curtis Jones to really kind of claim a place in midfield. So he's a player that I'm excited to see at that kind of start. Can he really hit it off? I'm looking forward to that.
Excellent stuff. Moving forward then, I'm beginning to talk about transfers, but coming at it from round the back, I want to talk about the homegrown / overseas question. Emma, Adrian was given the new deal and I was quite surprised, to be honest with you. He was almost given it. We talked about him on a show and then he was given the new deal. And it just felt a little bit like, oh my God, is this another example of Liverpool trying to make the content go off quickly? But one of the reasons why I was sceptical about the new deal was as much about this reason as anything else. So I think they must have a level of confidence, but I'll just run through it for you in terms of the overseas players. The following all qualifiers overseas and I'm now got a level of confidence. Liverpool see them as being part of the squad for the full season, no shadow of a doubt. Alisson Becker, Adrian, Joel Matip, Virgil van Dijk, Ibra Konate, Andy Robertson, Fabinho, Thiago Alcantara, Mo Salah, Sadio Mane, Roberto Firmino and Diogo Jota. They're the 12 definites. Then there's two where I think Liverpool may be vulnerable if the right offer came in, Kostas Tsimikas and Naby Keita. But expectations are both of them will be at Liverpool on the 1st of September. And then there's four that you classify as open to offers, and that is Divock Origi, Taki Minamino, Marco Grujic and Xherdan Shaqiri. That makes 18 and you can only register 17. Now, I want to see Liverpool do business as soon as possible, and I think there's other things in this. There's chats about cash flow, there's this, that and the other, don't get me wrong, but I think that whilst Liverpool have got 18 on the books, I think we might be in for a bit of a wait. They'll feel as though before they do anyone, you know, will come onto the main links, but almost all of them are overseas players. I think they'll be thinking they need to get at least two of those off the books, and I think there's only six, Shimikas, Keita, Origi, Minamino, Grujic and Shaqiri you can see that happening with.
Yeah, I agree with that list completely, actually. Maybe put Shaqiri maybe in the middle as one who...
In the Shimikas, Keita side.
Yeah, kind of. I think he will be open to offers, but I also think he's... I think he's got that character, and he's had it throughout his career where he probably is quite happy to just be a squad player. I hope he proves me wrong at some point, but I've never really seen anything yet in his career that makes me think he wants to go out and be starting week in, week out. So I don't see why that would change. You know, he's gone to the Euros and he's had a good Euro, so maybe he's thinking, you know, it's time for me to prove myself. But I would still put him in that category of probably being quite content staying at Liverpool. I am confident that Marko Grujic will get a move on. I think he is
quite,
that
I think
one.
Quite quickly, to
yeah,
be honest.
Yeah, and I think he is that one player that you look at among those six and go, surely he must be the first one.
And surely he's desperate for it himself.
Yeah, you know, he's gone out on loan and he is in kind of all things being said, he's had a successful one. So go out there and play your football abroad, because I think that's where he's shown his best. So I think he's going to be going. Naby Keita for me is the most interesting one, because depending on what offers come in, I think it'll be really interesting to see what Liverpool do with him and what kind of valuations are going to be splashed around. But yeah, personally, I think it'll be two if we're lucky out of those six, and Grujic will be definitely one of them.
But if it's only two, Emma, you end up in a situation where they can only have one more overseas qualified signing. This is the problem. This is the situation that they found themselves in now. That's all they'd have, is the wiggle room of only one overseas qualified signing, or someone's got to go out on loan.
Yeah, and I think this is where, you know, you see on Twitter and it's, oh, bringing this player. It's not just as simple as that. Obviously, you do have to maneuver things around in the squad. I personally don't think we'll be bringing in too many people. Maybe one more marquee signing, which will probably be overseas, you'd think. But then I think it'll be, you know, you'd be looking at the loan system to kind of bulk out your squad, but then also to offload, like you say.
I think the kingmaker in this could be Minamino. I actually think Liverpool could end up in a position where they're shackled with Grujic and Shaqiri, for example, at the end of August. I think if they get a 20 million off of Minamino now, I think that's where they'll be thinking, okay, that's the decision. That's the decision. And I think you're more likely to get that than one for Naby Keita, for example, if I'm being totally honest. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if he was the first one out the door.
On that, though, again, you need to do, I would have thought, three.
You do, but it's a chess game, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they'll know that, and they'll know that in order to do three, then you have to get the ball rolling with one. And I don't think there'll be an attitude of, well, we might sell Tachi, but we're going to see whether we can sell Grujic, Origi, Shaqiri first. I think if the right offer comes in for Minamino, I think they'll deal on him. And I think he's the one of interest for me. What happens to him will I think signify sort of how, not desperate, but how keen they are to sort of get that ball rolling and how aware they are of that situation.
Do you think that's why they loaned him out in the first place?
Yes. In a sort of long game point of view, I think that they seen that it wasn't going to happen. And I think that everybody is to a degree relaxed about that. And I think that they do think about players' welfare too. And I think that the concept of Minamino being sold for £20 to £25 million by Liverpool is something which can be seen by everyone as a positive and an experiment that is not in any way, shape or form deemed a failure. It was, you know, a real sort of astute buy, which was for near enough no money at all. They've made on the player. He's gone somewhere where he can get more football, and it's helped with this homegrown issue. So I think, yeah, I think it's one in which, like I say, if they can do it, I think they will.
As Dan's talking, then it actually reminds me, and it's funny that and again, because of loads of different things coming together, including what's been going on in the world the past couple of years, it reminds me of back when Benitez was in charge and he wanted to sell Xabi Alonso for 12 million. And I use the word wanted very loosely, and he was getting slated for it. And it's like, I reckon if you just sat down Rafa Benitez then and gone, do you want to sell Xabi Alonso for 12 million? He'd gone, absolutely not. Like, in my fantasy football world, I keep Xabi Alonso and I sell all these nonsense players over here and I get that money in and I buy Gareth Barry and I keep Barry and Alonso in the same squad because that's what's good, having more good footballers. But that's not how the real world works. And unfortunately, do you know, a lot of the world we see is nonsense on Twitter, where that's where people think. And that's what Emma was saying before. That's just not the way it works. And I agree with Dan completely. You are left with the realities of the situation. And you might say, yeah, we'll happily sell Shaqiri. And if everybody in the world goes, good luck with that, lads, then we go, well, okay, who can we sell? Because going back to your point, we've got to sell some of them. Someone's got to go. And you, Klopp might be sitting there thinking, in an ideal world, I'd keep Minamino. I think he's great. I think he's better. He's got more long-term potential. He's got more long-term value than these other lads. But if I can get 20 million for him, he's got to go.
The thing about this, though, Paul, is structurally, Liverpool are ever so slightly architects of their own downfall. If Adrian is going to be third-choice goalkeeper, for instance, doesn't have to be from overseas. You can like him and you can think he's sound and you can like the way he trains and the influence he has on other people, and I suspect that's a massive part of it and how a lot of this operates. But you can compromise on that. Like, there must be a level of confidence they have that they can get shut of a couple, because to have done Adrian that early, I mean, you know, it wasn't, maybe I'm wrong and maybe clubs were kicking a door down for him, or maybe he just wanted clarity on his own situation and was prepared to gamble on that and say, listen, if you don't let me know this week, we're moving house. Effectively, and that's what we're going to plan for. I understand that up to a point, but Liverpool, in the act of giving Adrian the contract, to me, it suggests they think they can get short of at least two, if not three or four.
Unless he's going out on loan.
It'd be mad to bring the 36-year-old keeper on loan.
What's his contract? 1 year?
Yeah, he's got another year, but he was out of contract this summer, so they could just have let him go and got another sub keeper in.
Yeah, so it's funny this, isn't it? Because in the past, if this had happened, I'd have said, well, one of the potential explanations, as I say, about basically 99% of what goes on in the world ever is incompetence. Like, I think there's far too much, like, we overthink everything in the world, when loads of the answers, loads of the time, is no one really thought about it that much, to be honest. Yeah. Like, just no one really knows what's going on. And someone's gone, like, they've signed him, and then someone's gone, do you know about the, we can only have 17 foreign
lads? They knew about it in the reason why I don't stand for that is they knew about it in January.
No, well, look, so what I was about to say is, that's what I'd have said loads of times in the past. With any football club, not just Liverpool, I just don't think that happens now. I just think at the level that we're talking about, squad building, management, signings, ins and outs, we're way, way too sophisticated for that now, which only can lead you to the point you just made, which suggests they've got a clear plan and they'll be all right and they know what they're doing and they don't need to panic too much. Because otherwise, as you said, they've made a massive rod for their own back.
The next part of this for me, Emma, is in general, and in the context to a certain extent of City's projected moves for Grealish and Kane. Yeah. And both of them come with, for the amount of money you're talking about, they come with a couple more question marks than I would have thought for that amount of money, in completely different ways, really, and some of them are tactical. But what that in part makes me think is, one of the things City are thinking about is, we need to not be at the whim of the homegrown thing. Yeah. And I do wonder with Liverpool whether or not at some point you've got to find a shift of policy so that this isn't an issue every window or every season. You've got to do little things. If players that suit you come available, you've got to do something. But then the flip side of that is that we're expecting them to shift on Phillips and Nico Williams this summer, both of whom would go on to qualify as homegrown. I'm surprised that maybe Liverpool haven't tried to get a bit more of a grip of it earlier, is what I'm sort of saying.
Yeah, it's... The Man City thing is really interesting, because it's almost like they've kind of reacted to that, you know, quite last minute. We're talking there about there being kind of a sophisticated plan, and Man City, you know, there's no hiding away from the fact that, obviously, you know, they basically got a load of money and they've spent it, brought some players in. So yes, it probably is that their long-term plan was actually, in comparison to Liverpool's, a short-term one, and they've gone, we need some English players in. And that's where I think it is really interesting for Liverpool, because Jurgen Klopp came in, he knew what players he wanted, he knew what type of players he wanted. He's kind of asked for these, got, you know, most of them. He's almost got kind of the jigsaw all together now. And then it's like, right, we've kind of gone on and achieved what his immediate goal was, which was obviously to win the Premier League. Now it's, how do we rebuild for the future? And he's almost got to replace those puzzle pieces now with ones that he can for the future. And I think this is where I'll come back to kind of what I was saying before about Liverpool's academy. And you just hope that those homegrown players actually come through the academy, as opposed to Liverpool actually having to go out and buy the homegrown quota. So if you get those players coming through the academy, then you probably can work on a policy of every season getting rid of 2, 3, 4 foreign players, bringing in the same amount, and just kind of relying on that constant of having that youth come through the homegrown.
Last three summers, last Manchester City player who was homegrown that they bought?
Nathan Ake.
Indeed, great one. Very pleased. Gold star for that. Dan wins the show. Sorry, everyone else, you've all done.
He deserves it.
He deserves it, doesn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But that is, so before that, then the one before that's Kyle Walker. That's how far back you've got to go to point out a homegrown player that was bought by Manchester City. That's why, as I say, I'm not surprised by that. But this is Dan as someone who has argued, from my point of view, completely rightly, about the qualities of Mr. Harvey Barnes at Leicester City on shows at the Anfield Rap in the past. I think where Liverpool can do this, they've got to start looking to. So I understand, I completely take Emma's point that you want to do it through homegrown youngsters, you want to do it through the youth setup. That's your ideal. But ultimately, they could just do with, I'd like to think someone sat down has got a proper plan for keeping this wolf from the door, and that this isn't going to be a year in, year out sort of situation, that for three more summers we're sat here chatting about homegrown stuff. If Liverpool, you know, if Liverpool can get players in, quality players in, who are homegrown, and this is why they could talk about it as a premium, we're living that reality.
I think that's the thing. I think in essence, you probably need one a season for the next three seasons, and you can do enough working around that internally to make it work. And I think that's where it's for me, it's the concept of, well, you might as well go big or not at all. And, you know, you don't get your kecks pulled down, because Liverpool don't do that, and they that's not how they do their business. But I think a premium for someone like Harvey Barnes, who doesn't just solve a homegrown quota, but you are able to say, okay, we're happy enough fitness-wise in terms of his injury, that this lad sorts the next 10 years for us. That's where the premium sort of value for money comes in. And I think that's where, look, those players aren't always available, and they have to be the right player for the situation that you're in, and it has to be massively contextualised to what you need. But I think if you can identify that player, I think if you can hold your nerve a little bit, I think if you can sort of not get into silly money conversations, as in Kane Grealish territory, then I think it's worth doing. And I think that, like I say, you have to look at this and say, well, if we take the Man City question you've just given me and flip it on its head, well, how many times have Liverpool sort of signed a Harvey Elliott under Jurgen Klopp? Once, because it's Harvey Elliott. And so Harvey Elliott, what that says to me is Harvey Elliott isn't around all the time. So if you get this, look, there'll be cheaper ways of doing it, and there'll be ways of tying over if you want to do it in terms of sticking plasters on things and bringing homegrown, with all due respect, Minamino type situations to the table. But I think for someone like Barnes, to use him as an example, he just strikes me as a player who, if they were happy with him, you could look at him and say, okay, well, this isn't just solving this problem, this is a homegrown player who can potentially do Liverpool, you know, incredibly good things for the next 10 years. So
you've also just made bits of my Dele Alli argument, that you can also find one who's out of favour and having a bit of a moment and give him a change of scene and see if that works for you for 3 or 4 years. But we will park my Dele Alli argument, as it is based on sand, for a minute or two. Just quick on the signings, Paul. In fact, I'll go Emma first. Saul, Tielemans, Marlon, Barella, to an extent, they're all similar-ish in profile. I think it's there's very little at the minute that's linking Liverpool to, for instance, a central defender or a right back. All the noises are of central midfielders who can be, because we don't know how to describe them otherwise, described as box to box, and bits and pieces around mobile forwards.
Yeah, and out of those four names, Tielemans is one that I've been, you know, sort of shouting about for a while now. I always come down to, when it comes to signing players, ones that you know. And yes, you can watch players in Europe. Yes, you can see their talent. But if you've seen them do it week in, week out in the Premier League, which Tielemans has done to an extremely high level, then you know exactly what you're getting. So, yeah, we're linked with these players. I think Barella is obviously another one who's quite exciting for me, but I will always look to the players who have shown it and proven it week in, week out. So if we are to bring any of those players in, then Tielemans is top of the list for me.
For you, you're expecting midfielder and forward still. I mean, I keep asking it on every show, but the squad's not changing. I'm expecting a midfielder and a forward once they manage to shake a lot of this stuff out. I might be wrong, but that's what I'm expecting.
Yeah, but it comes back to what we said before. There's just so many moving parts to this. It's really difficult. And then when it comes to which of them, because, I mean, you know, if you're asking me, do I want those, then yeah, of course. But and then when it comes back to which of those on that list, I'm with Emma and talking about, you know, types of players and where they're coming from. This might actually just, I was thinking this could be nonsense. This could just be something we think, that buying a lad who already plays in the Premier League is more likely to settle in quicker. I'm not sure how true that is. I'm not sure how that pans out with actual stats and history. Because straight away, someone like Fernando Torres comes into my head, who comes in from another league and just wipes the floor with everyone. That we've seen that in the past, how many times, where someone comes in and goes, sorry, this is the best league in the world. Oh, I'm just going to tear it up. That's fine.
Nistelrooy.
Yeah, absolutely. So that can happen. I just think in the context of everything that's gone on globally now and where we all are, the whole getting someone to move countries, settle into new environments, what are they like with the language, culture, house, all that sort of thing. If you can minimise as much of that as possible, you get a better chance of success. And I think right now, that's what you've got to be looking to do. This is a moving part thing. Football fans, generally speaking, we're thinking about this season. Now, the lads on that list, if they are the lads that Liverpool are looking at, they might not be looking at this season at all. It goes back to the Thiago conversation. Yeah. We've said this in the weeks gone by. In our heads, we signed Thiago last season, so he's last season signing now. But in Klopp and Linda's heads, Thiago is maybe this season's signing. Because he's had the year to settle in and he's done all the things we've just been talking about and he's fine now. He knows the lads. And even that has been a weird year for him. Klopp has referenced this.
Yeah.
You know, can't sit near each other in the dressing room, can't go out for a meal, can't do all the usual stuff we'd usually do. So they might be thinking, yeah, you know, that's something that made me laugh when I was sort of replugged into Twitter the other day. This never ends. Like, whenever we get linked to a new midfielder, everyone starts doing that, and here's what the midfield will be. And it never has Jordan Henderson in it. And I'm like, lads, I don't know how long we have to keep saying this to you. He's Jurgen Klopp's captain who won everything.
Yeah.
Like, how much more do you want to see that Klopp loves him and adores him? And going back to what you said before as well, he hasn't got long left. But neither of them. Klopp's got until 2024. Is Henderson 30 now?
Yeah.
So what's Henderson got? The way he plays football, especially, and the injuries he's been picking up. You could easily go start of the season Fabinho, Thiago, Henderson, and I mean, depends on what we're saying about, you know, the passing of the baton and all that. That if that's your main midfield for the bulk of the season, what a midfield.
Yeah.
Well, then you can buy one of these other lads and give him 6 months.
And I think people are forgetting as well how many games Wijnaldum played. He was the ever present in that midfield. Yeah. So one of those three names already in that Liverpool squad, and it probably is going to be either one of Henderson or Fabinho, has got to become the ever present. And that's difficult for a player who's aging, and Fabinho, who's obviously had a past of injuries. So when you're looking at players bringing in, and that's why Tielemans is another one, you know, for me, that I've said that it's another reason why, is because he's an ever present. And I think that is really, really important for Liverpool.
I think, yeah, the Sol Tielemans thing really interests me, because they strike me as players who, like Emma says, you sort of have to play them along with the other two in that sense. And you have to sort of say, if it's Sol, for example, pedigree Atletico Madrid, hugely talented, top European midfielder, he comes in and you're not going to say, well, if he gets 30 games a season, that's all right. You're not looking at him for that. What you're then saying is, okay, it's Henderson, Fabinho, Niguez, great. But where does Chamberlain get his games? How does Naby get his momentum? How does Curtis carry on his development? What about Milner? The balance is what we don't know in terms of what they're thinking right now. Do they trust enough in what they've got to say, okay, well, we need a forward and we're just going to swallow the genie thing and see how that goes, because we will take the
punt. That feels like a massive risk, doesn't it?
It does. It does. But then you could say the same that they might think, well, okay, we'll do the midfielder, but we might not do the forward because we've got Jota, we think Harvey's going to come on leaps and bounds, and we've got the front three. And what you're saying is they might still do both. I'm not entirely certain he will. And it just comes back to the situational context of, is it ready now? Is this the right time? Is the player there? Is the value for money there?
What's interesting on Tielemans and Saul on that, for me, Dan, is the fact, well, Saul's 25 going on 26. I think I'm right in saying Tielemans has just done a big full season with Leicester, did a full season the season before, will view himself as you say, if you buy me, I'm playing. That's the purpose of it. And if you're going to spend 60, 65 million on a footballer, it's perfectly legitimate for everybody to say, so he's playing every week then, wherever he is. But that's why the Bissouma thing always made a bit more sense to me, in that what that means is you've got someone who can come in, arguably be number four of a three-man midfield, but back him to be available and be able to say there's a year here of development where you're then going to become Liverpool's first choice centre midfielder. That's why that one's always made more sense to me, the idea. And in general, Liverpool have got a big hole aged between 22 and 25. That's what I thought they'd be. I thought the next midfielder would be 22 to 25. These lads, either in an experience in inverted commas sense with Tielemans or Saul or a couple of the others, they all seem a bit more senior maybe than I was expecting. They all feel like they're being bought for now.
I completely agree. And I agree fundamentally, because if you think about it, there's no way in which Liverpool let Wijnaldum go to spend 65 million on replacing him. They'd just stump up the extra wages and maybe go, all right, you want a 4-year deal at what might it be, 170 per week. We'll give you 3 years at 140. And that's where the compromise would be. Because they'd rather have the continuity. And I get all the arguments around Wijnaldum that I think, you know, in 12, 15 months, we all might be looking at him going, oh my God, his legs have gone. And that's completely fine. But I don't think the model has never been about replacements and replacements on big money. You know, Coutinho never got replaced as the classic. We know that. But I think the idea would be, okay, we back the squad and it's about development. And with the gap that we've got, it's all about development. And I think that's where you then look at, like you say, the Bissouma type player. You then look at the 22 to 25-year-old forward who could maybe be doing a little bit of sort of Bobby kind of stuff if they've got options either side. I think that's what they're ideally looking at. Like I said before, are they available? Who are they? Because they're very good at plucking a name out of thin air, but it feels like, and believe me, I know through working in it, there is no name that has been left unscoured throughout the world of football. So, and I can't say who it is.
But we'd have said that if we were sat here, I'll come back to you one more time, I'm not trying to do your head in, we'd have said that if we were sat here last year, no one would have said Jota.
Well, to be fair, Neil, I did in the transfer show, but, you know.
you take me point.
I take your point.
The thing that's in my head is I did a bit of a thing yesterday with some stats stuff, just playing around in ours, because, you know, I didn't have enough on. And one of the things I was trying to work out is there a centre mid Jota style move in the league at the minute? And I sort of end up in a Ward-Prowse area in a strange way, but I just think that the premium on Ward-Prowse, because he's Southampton's captain and he's so important to them, just becomes too great. You know, I was trying to think who's the one who's a bit of a diddle, where can do a couple of positions, so he'll get 70% of the games, but without holding down absolute nailed on first team, this is what we're about. Who's sort of, Ward-Prowse is arguably now a little bit too old for what I'm sort of thinking, but who's of that age range. There actually just isn't anyone really that to me sort of, you go, well, it could well be him.
I wonder if, sorry, I'll let someone else come in now, but I wonder if by us following the data of what they've done before, we're actually missing a bit of a trick.
Oh yeah.
So if Liverpool go and sign Suchek from West Ham, for example, and everyone goes, what are they doing? That is just the most left field. Actually, that signing could have been prepared for 2 years. It wasn't Thomas Suchek, but it was the player of that profile. In 18 months to 15 months' time, you know, this is what we need, because we've envisaged the lay of land will be this. Or midway through last season, we've decided we're going down this route because we can see this path taking shape. And that's where I think we might all end up, is that we're rightly all looking for the next Jota, the next Wijnaldum, the next thing that's already there.
For me, I think it is the next Henderson. I think they're buying to replace Henderson. Right. That's my argument.
It's fair.
that they're going to use head on that. Thiago replaces Wijnaldum. Someone comes in and replaces Henderson, and they're going ahead on that. Anyway, more of that on the gutter. Do subscribe to the Anfield Wrap if you haven't done so. New season, new excitement, new journey for us all to go on together. TheAnfieldWrap.com/subscribe and download the app. But to sum up and to end last season, we'll have a little bit of a chat about the Euros before finishing off. Emma, England have hard lines in the end, but Italy would have had hard lines too if it had gone the other way. There'll be a lot written about the second half of England versus Italy and the England manager's approach. It actually reminded me a little bit of Liverpool versus Tottenham Hotspur in the 2019 Champions League final.
Yeah.
That sometimes everyone's legs are a bit wobbly. What you have, you hold, and you see if you can get through it, and then you go from there. I think he could make his changes a bit earlier, but it's his job, not mine. And apart from that, we don't really need to write the words, but people will.
Yeah, I almost think, if anything, England took the lead too early. You know, they've got so many young players, so many fearless players, and it was almost like they had a game plan of how to break down the Italian press and their defence, blah, blah, blah. And they did it within 3 minutes. And then it's like, oh, okay. Now what do we do? Okay, we've got to try and hold on to this for 87 minutes in a Euro final. And I almost think that kind of played into their minds a little bit. And it was a case of just knocking off minutes, as opposed to kind of just going out and playing the football and playing the game plan and doing kind of what they'd done throughout the knockout stages, I'd say, of the tournament. But yeah, it's such a young team that I think there was going to be mistakes on Gareth's part. There was going to be mistakes on the team's part. And actually, the substitutions that he made, you look at Henderson, for example, coming on, and it made sense at that time. And
just well, Henderson.
Yeah, I mean, I think he did. But then I also think what maybe Gareth wanted from him was to almost slow things down. And if anything, he was excited and wanted to get on the ball and wanted to make things happen. And you probably just needed him to do a couple of sideways passes and a couple of backwards passes just to slow things down. So it was almost in kind of those elements where I was like, that's where England's naivety of being in a Euro 2020 final probably showed. And at the end of the day, it was the experience that came through, because Italy, despite going a goal down, didn't really change the way that they played. They changed tactically. They changed in terms of their positioning and their game plan. But in terms of the actual individual performances, they still played with the same kind of assurity, and they still got on the ball and played how they would usually. And I think ultimately that was what cost England.
In international tournaments, I always feel, because there's no peaks and troughs like there is across the course of a 10-month season, and there's not four competitions that you can potentially win, how and when you lose matters for me, Paul, in that 24 teams enter the Euros, and 23 of them we can say with certainty will not win, will not succeed, will not lift the shiny thing at the end, which you can't say again about sort of full season football. And this is the bit that I always feel gets a little bit missed. So how you lose, when you lose, matters. And looking at the tournament, one of the things that's really interesting, people talk about it being a good tournament. I think one of the reasons why, in a sense, is that all of the last eight now, because Belgium get knocked out by Italy, I think all of the last eight now are able to look at it and go, good tournament. We're happy with what happened to us. Denmark, would they love to have won it? Of course they would. But losing to England in Wembley for the semi-final, it happens. It happens. Tough penalty.
Yeah.
Go home with pride. You know, Croatia will feel as though they've underperformed, but the Czech Republic will feel absolutely fucking fantastic. Sweden, last 16, feel like they missed a real opportunity. Ukraine, yes, they get hammered by England, but in the end, were they expecting to do better in the quarters? I think it's really interesting that this is a tournament where, as I say, all the last eight, wherever they ended up, Italy as winners, England as runners-up, ultimately should walk away feeling like, done well, done really, really well, giving everyone a good ride.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of looking at it. I actually think the only thing I was going to disagree on, but then the old conquerors rule probably comes in, is that maybe Spain would be disappointed. But I think the fact that Italy went on to win...
Same with Belgium, that's what we think,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, what you said about Belgium, that's what made me think of conquerors. It's like, yeah, well... I often think that, like, whenever we get knocked out of the Champions League, you want that team to go on and win it then.
Yeah.
Because if they go on and win it, it just feels a bit nicer, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's like, yeah, well, we got knocked out by the winners, so that's fair enough. I think that if I was an England fan, and I was, it was actually really interesting watching high level football and not being that arsed either way. Also worth noting, I watched it with my mum and dad, and if no one picks up my mum as co-commentator for the World Cup, they are missing a massive trip. Like, some gold dust in there, Neil, honestly. Like, you should get her on hot mic. I'll just share a couple of them with you. When Spain scored in the semi against Italy, the first thing she said was, they should have just tried to score sooner. Which, I mean, you can't argue with that.
Can't argue with that.
That is absolute on the money. I can't remember what I was talking about now. So, yeah, I think generally speaking, everyone did okay. I do think if I was an England fan, I'd be... And this goes for Spain as well, to be honest. I loved it. I think everybody who was semi-neutral loved Italy from the first game. They were great. The way they played was fantastic. When I saw them against Spain, because I didn't really like Spain, when I saw the Italy without Spinazzola against Spain, I was like, oh, this is a completely different thing. You can't... I was referencing me and conversations you and I have had about... and we've probably all had about Liverpool and Trent and with other people who have fans for the teams don't really know, and saying they've done the thing that everyone always does with Liverpool, whereas when Trent's out, people go, you need to put a right back in. No, you don't. He's not a right back. Yeah. Like, if you just put a right back into our team instead of Trent, like, the whole thing doesn't work anymore. It was the same with Spinazzola. You take Spinazzola out the Italian setup and put a left back in, and you're like, sorry, what's this whole team looks different now?
Yeah.
So in that context, I think Spain would be disappointed not to win, and I have to say that for England as well. I think without him, they're not as good. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, even for England, I suppose you get to a final, you lose on penalties, that can happen. I agree with you 100% on the... One of the other things my mum said during the game was, this is crap. And I had to point out to her. And it was interesting, Lineker did this once during, I think, half-time. Like, mentioning to people who don't watch a lot of football what football is like to watch. Because it's like this idea that finals are great. And I went to me, finals are often crap.
Yeah.
Like, the Spurs Champions League final was awful.
Yeah.
It was absolutely awful. Apart from for us, because we won. And we did that thing, and they say we scored early. Everyone's like, what do we do now? And it turned out lovely because Divock scores an iconic goal that wraps it up right at the end, and it's lovely. But the whole game was rubbish, pretty much, if it wasn't for all that. Imagine saying to a Spurs fan, what do you think of that final? Any good? Like, yeah. No, I would never watch it again in my life. Never want to think about it again.
No, I think all of that's fair, Dan. It is all fair. The World Cup shapes up quite nicely, I think. Spain will go into it feeling as though they back themselves a fair bit off the back of it. I think within that, Germany have got a bit of a resurgence going. Last throw of the dice for Belgium. Italy now going in there looking like a very good side. And obviously England is a massive part of that as well. I think it's, you know, from an England point of view, a semi-final and a final is absolutely creditable and has got to be acknowledged as such. That World Cup does shape up nicely, I think, for a lot of teams. There'll be a lot of teams walking into that wanting to get possibly a nicest draw, but feeling as though they can do something.
It does shape up, yeah. I think
keep your eye on Morocco, by the way. Loads of good players on the side.
Interesting. Nice. Yeah, look, I think a lot can change between then and now. That's an obvious thing to say. I think on England, and I'd probably bracket Belgium in this too, I think there's still a bit of an identity crisis there around who they are and what they are, and I think on the face of it, a semi-final and a final in a major competition, you can say, okay, the trajectory there is absolutely fine and that's going in the right direction. I just think there's times last night where you see they're not quite sure what they should be in those situations, and I think that the whole 66 thing around them that still looms, like, I think that the best thing that could have happened in so many ways last night, that they could have won that final. And I think, I mean that in terms of the culture of what England is as a football team, who they are as a group of players, what they stand for. And I think, to use the Liverpool example, I think you see this, if you use Cope's analogy of the 2019 finals, that Liverpool just know that in that situation of 1-0, they can get to where they need to be and they can control things at their level. And should Tottenham go on to score, which they do, nearly do, sorry, in that game that we often forget, only for the goalkeeper a few times, that, you know, Liverpool would still manage themselves to regroup and live within the identity they created for themselves, which was a 97-point team. I think with England, there's that little bit of uncertainty still around what you do when you go a goal up in a final in 2 minutes, and whether or not you are within your boundaries to go and put your foot on the throat and get the second goal and then absolutely kill the contest from there. And what they sort of end up with last night is that little bit of a halfway house where they're not entirely sure, and then that doubt creeps in, and then the self-fulfilling prophecy comes in when Italy do eventually score. And look, it could have gone the other way on penalties, but my point is England should be winning competitions with that squad, and I am not dressing that up in any other way, shape or form, and I'm not trying to be sort of subversive in having a dig at anyone there, but that squad is incredibly talented. Mm. And when you see what they can bring off the bench in five substitutions, that is a squad that we talked about, the sort of Gerard Lampard generation. This is, for me, next level talent that should be winning competitions and should be asserting itself a little bit more than what it does. And I'll say is that I can think you can make that element both sides, in that they sort of know when to flat track against the likes of Ukraine and Denmark to a degree. So you can see that the development is there, that those games in other competitions in years gone by would have been ones in which they'd have ended up with egg on the face and everyone's then sort of laughing at the English kind of thing. So they are fixing those issues. I just think that test of Italy last night was one which showed them up.
I think what I think is interesting, like for instance, I'm looking at the Italian squad and going into extra time, I think I messaged someone and said something along the lines of, the difference here, Chiesa has gone off. He was the best attacker on the night.
Yeah.
But he's gone off. England have still got Raheem Sterling, who is the best attacker, who in the last four was the best attacker left in the tournament. And I was thinking that would make the difference. I was thinking if Italy had Sterling, I'd, you know, make them sort of favourites at this moment to win it. But England have got Sterling and it goes that way, Emma. What I think is interesting for them to sort of engage with and think about is, I hated it when it used to happen to Liverpool, and I hate it whenever it happens to any team, which is when everyone does this, well, they haven't played anyone good yet.
Yeah.
In that, but I hate it more in international tournaments. And the reason why is, and this isn't about the English or anyone else, no one's actually that good. Because you can't solve your problems through the transfer market. You've got who you've got, and you've just got to cop for it. So everyone's got holes. I don't think there is not. Chiesa looks really exciting, but there's not a genuine elite, world-class, my God, attacker who plays for Italy, but they've won the tournament and they've won however many international games. Yeah. And I think that's the big thing I think everyone should try to learn from this, is that all these squads, Argentina the same, Brazil the same, you know, Belgium, who've got an unbelievable crop of players, the same. Everyone's really flawed. These actually aren't that good a set of sides. So you're more than good enough. You'll always be able to say, well, you haven't played anyone yet.
Yeah, it's such an interesting conversation, this, because I actually had this with somebody at work at the beginning of the tournament, where, yes, I actually don't think many international teams are great, because they never played together. Like, they never, ever, ever played together. You've got, I mean, Rio Ferdinand was talking about it a little bit, I think, last night. And it was, you know, you've got a squad full of, Manchester United players playing with Liverpool players, playing with Manchester City players. Yes, I think Gareth Southgate has managed to bring them together.
As Mancini has.
But that's such a rarity. And so that's probably the hardest thing to do as an international manager, is to bring these players who literally kick the crap out of each other every week in their leagues and bring them together and all have a collective goal. So I think you have to applaud those managers on that. But yeah, in terms of actually getting any fluency, it's really, really difficult. And in terms of actually having any development time, it's really, really difficult. So you look at some of the most successful teams, and obviously, France won the World Cup and they had Olivier Giroud basically as their kind of main striker. And you know, and Benzema has been that for them as well. And it's well, you look at the likes of Griezmann and players that they've had in the past, and you know, Brazil have got Neymar, but it's world-class players all together, just kind of thrown into one mix, and it's about finding that balance, and that's the hardest thing to do at international football.
Okay, be excited about the new season. Be very, very excited indeed with us on the Anfield Wrap. Everything that you need, and as soon as we get some pre-season fixtures worked out, we'll be working out what our reaction shows will look like. On the end of last season, the other thing that happens, a lot of unpleasantness around the England team. I know a lot of people who listen to the Anfield Rap wouldn't associate themselves with that for a variety of reasons, but the point about all of this is that it's insidious. It needs challenging at every turn, and you shouldn't be complacent about it either. Liverpool supporters shouldn't be complacent about anything, however you might feel at any different stages about seeing other people's behaviour online or offline. Complacency around these things is one of the reasons why they always creep back in, and there was a period of time where I think for England supporters during this tournament they felt a lot of that had been eradicated, and then suddenly it reappears. So we must not all, none of us should be complacent around all of these horrible elements that go on around people who are deemed not to be, in inverted commas, normal football supporters, and by that I mean predominantly white men. Think about the women close to you, think about the people of other ethnic backgrounds close to you as well, and other sexuality based backgrounds, and try to be caring towards them at all times. That will always be the measure, but challenge, it's not enough just to be nice, challenge those who aren't at every opportunity and at all times. Thank you very much indeed to Paul Cope, to Emma Sanders and to Dan Morgan. It has been the Anfield Wrap this week, and we are very, very excited because, you know what, we're on the march. Sports Social Podcast Network.